And what are we here to talk about tonight?
Andy Warhol.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and I'm back with another episode of the podcast where we talk to people about their favorite things. This week, I have my pod mate, my indoor friend for the quarantine, Ezra Butler. You'll find Ezra on Twitter at Ezra Butler. He's on Instagram under the same name. Also on Instagram as Ezra Butler Art. We are longtime friends originally from the internet and crossed over into real life 12 or 13 years ago. So pretty fantastic. I hope you are all doing well. This has been another very difficult week. Thank you to everyone who sent well wishes, thoughts, and condolences about Lucy. I think true to Lucy's spirit, I found two other friends in completely different circles who also knew Lucy. And so that she just had this tremendous network of good people. So thank you for your notes about her. As we head into this week, it's Martin Luther King Jr. Day on Monday. And then later in the week is the Biden inauguration. And then we begin the long process of fixing the systems we live in the United States. So without further ado, here's my interview with Ezra Butler. Follow him online and stay home, stay safe, wear your mask, and wash your hands. Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the pod. What?
Are we live?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that we were recording already.
Yeah. Okay. Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the podcast where we find out about people's favorite things without using an algorithm. This week, I am joined at my dining room table, across the table from me, by my pod mate and upstairs neighbor, who you've heard me mention from time to time in many interviews, Ezra Butler. How are you doing tonight, Ezra?
I'm great. Yeah. We just had a great dinner.
We did. We had Faya.
Yeah.
So we... Here's the thing, listeners. I've never done an in-person podcast before. Normally, I'm on Zoom, where there's a delay built in that gives you time to sense how somebody is reacting to your question. And normally there's two tracks. So when there's hesitations or internet goes bonkers, I mute that out. I do not have the technical skills to bring you this podcast today with two microphones, nor do I know how to do an interview in person. So tonight's an experiment. But as I've said all along, we're learning in person.
Well, it's also a conversation, and basically we're inviting everybody to listen to one of our many conversations that we have on any given night of the week.
I know. We used to have them in the yard.
Yes.
Before it was snowing.
It's cold out.
It's not so cold. You are also now properly outfitted for a Midwestern winter.
You know what is weird about that? So I, on your advice, I bought that like really heavy lens and coat.
Mm-hmm.
And you said you have to wear this heavy coat and it's got to cover your butt and your head and everything. And today I went to Mariano's and I was wearing...
Were you schwitzing?
I was schwitzing so much. And then as I was walking home, it wasn't that cold. It was 30 whatever. And I'm hot. I get into my apartment because I'm also wearing this N95 mask, And I just like take it off and I'm literally sweating because it was so hot out. Well, with the jacket on.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, the advice we gave you was advice for winter where you're commuting and you're going on and off the train and you're walking through wind tunnels downtown. And not for like a kind of strangely warm winter. Although, knock on wood. Not knock on wood. I don't want this to happen. There might be a polar vortex coming.
That's fun. When I do my morning walk every day to the coffee shop.
Yeah.
And I put on this jacket and then I zip it up. I feel like a penguin because, you know, the feet don't like, I waddle there and I waddle back and.
But walking like a penguin keeps you upright.
Yes, I feel very upright.
Yes, it's the trick.
Yes.
Ezra and I met on Twitter, as I met many of my guests.
No, we did not.
How did we meet?
We met on the Tel Aviv pier. Wait, did we meet before? Did we meet virtually before that, or did I meet you?
I am certain we met each other virtually on Twitter and then met in person at Mash Bash when Ahuva was...
2008.
So I went to Israel for the first time in 2006. And then I returned in March of 2006. I went for the first time. I returned the summer of 2007. Twitter had been open since March of 2007. So maybe it was March. Maybe it was summer of 2008 that we met in person.
It must have been 2008 because A, I remember Mash Bash 2008, and B, 2007 doesn't make sense in that.
In your timeline?
In my timeline.
So you are saying we didn't follow each other until we met in the corner of the Mash Bash when Ahuva made all those lovely stickers. And you put on a name tag that said at Ezra Butler and I put on one that said at Leah Jones and we had never followed each other before.
You're probably right. But that was my now I know Leah Jones.
Yes.
And since then... We've hung out in multiple cities.
We've hung out in Tel Aviv, Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago.
Yeah. And I actually flew here for a birthday of yours.
Ezra was one of the co-chairs of my 40th birthday party.
And as we were both sitting in our respective apartments alone during this pandemic that we are currently having, we spoke quite frequently.
Yes.
And one day, Leah said that, tweeted, she didn't even tell me about this, that there was an opening in her building. And I tweeted back at her, it was a Saturday night. And my response was, am I moving to Chicago? And within 48 hours, I signed the contract and I moved to Chicago.
You've been here since Labor Day-ish, Labor Day-ish weekend.
September 1st.
Yeah. You moved cross-country in a U-Haul. Mm-hmm. Luckily, we live across the street from a large parking lot, so you didn't have to parallel park the U-Haul in Chicago.
Right. Yes.
Right? You didn't.
I don't think so.
No. So, you know, usually I ask, how's this pandemic going for you? And I'm going to ask you the same thing. How's this pandemic going for you?
Well, I've got this amazing downstairs neighbor.
I know. Jen and Matt are great, right?
They are. No, I mean, like, I needed drugs the other day. I mean, Tylenol.
Yep.
The other day, and I just texted Jen, and she's like, sure, I'll give you drugs. I mean, Tylenol.
Yep.
And people keep on asking me, like, how's Chicago? And I know my room, mm-hmm. my view.
Yeah.
And your apartment.
Yeah.
And that's my Chicago.
Your Chicago also includes a coffee shop that you put your hand into every day.
Yes.
A shared beloved brunch place that you pick up your weekend brunch.
Yes. Ooh, which they're coming back next Tuesday.
Okay, good. So we're talking about, for listeners in Chicago, we're talking about the Ravenswood staple, Over Easy. Which, since Ezra got to Chicago, one of the things you've been amazed by is that Chicago's really good for people who eat gluten-free.
Amazing. I mean, this fireplace, which if you live in Chicago, you must go to Andersonville and just pick up but eat at home because there's still a pandemic. They have gluten-free pizza. And it is the best gluten-free pizza that I've had in Chicago. And it's not the only gluten-free pizza that I've had in Chicago. So I have a comparison.
Yeah.
And it's still the best.
Yeah. So Over Easy now has gluten-free pancakes, French toast.
They have bread.
Yeah.
And they have a French toast, yes.
Yeah. I wasn't telling Ezra that on the weekends I was going and picking up brunch from Over Easy because I didn't know they had gluten-free food. And so I didn't want to brag on him about like these amazing brunches I was getting. And then one day we were like on WhatsApp from two floors away from each other talking about brunch. And I looked and I was like, oh, they at least have gluten-free toast. And then he looked at it with a finer eye and noticed there were more than just toast options. So,
but ironically, we've actually never had brunch together from there.
That's true. That would be a step too far.
Yeah.
Over Easy is a place I go by myself. Or I tell friends, order for an 11 a.m. pickup and we'll go to the dugout. We'll go to the baseball field across the street.
I get it. You know, we all need our, you know, space and our, you know,
I'm an outdoor brunch person.
Yes.
Moving to Chicago in the middle of a pandemic is not a great way to get to know Chicago. But, you know, the grid now?
Yeah. You forced me to learn the grid on my first day here. And I was able to, I had walked over to Lake Michigan. Mm-hmm. And then I promptly got lost because I was like walking all around and I walked to a street and I looked at the number and I knew exactly where I was. And I thought, wow, Leah's probably felling right now about how I'm not lost.
I was. So yeah, so Ezra and I met 12 years ago, coming up on 13.
Yeah.
We're coming up on our bar mitzvah of our friendship. Mostly has been a long distance friendship, and now we are pod mates, and now he's on my podcast.
Yes, and I actually had a really hard time. Like, I remember when you did your first podcast, and we spoke before that, and I was kind of insulted that you never asked me to join your podcast, and you said to me, well, no, I've asked, but you don't know what your favorite thing is. And it was really hard figuring out what my favorite thing is.
Yeah. Because when I asked Ezra about it, he said, my favorite thing is art. And I'm throwing my arms open for those of you who can't see me. And I was like, you gotta focus in a little bit. And he was like, I like dance. I was like, I need a little bit more focus. Modern dance. And so we did this dance of favorite things and getting him to focus on, I soothed your nerves so that you understood I loved you. And I had, in fact, invited you to be on my podcast. And you just, like, hadn't picked a topic. And over the last couple of weeks, you got serious about narrowing it down. And what are we here to talk about tonight?
Andy Warhol.
Andy Warhol.
Was a lot of things, and I think that that's what I love about him. But even more, over the last, I guess, 15 years, in many ways, Andy Warhol has kind of resurfaced in different venues and different aspects.
Yeah, So for people listening, I will obviously, like, the show notes will be full of notes. Andy Warhol, at the most basic level, you know him for the Campbell Soup lithograph.
Right. So screen prints, I think, actually they were. So Andy Warhol was born in Pittsburgh and in the 50s had moved to New York and was an out gay man, and he was an illustrator for Madison Avenue. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, he basically switched from this kind of, actually really fine art kind of illustrations to the pop art as we know it now.
Yeah.
And what's so fascinating about him is that you say he's known for his Campbell's soup cans. Other people think that he's famous for his Marilyns.
Mm-hmm.
Other people, you know, may think that he's famous for his Mao. Or there are so many different things that he had done, and his art really goes the gamut.
Yeah.
And what I loved about him so much, and what I love about him, is that he could draw. And by the way, this is one of these things which I've noticed with everyone from Mondrian to Kandinsky to like all these just artists that it looks like, oh, my child could do that, or it's just lines, or it's just these symbols and they're meaningless. And then you look at their earlier stuff and yeah. You're like, they can paint. They have talent, meaning they can tell a story using a traditional scene, or they could do what they want to do
right.
In this other way.
And do something abstract. I think I was listening to a podcast before dinner. People's go-to for this type of explanation is Picasso. So before Picasso was able to draw an abstract face, he was a fine artist. It was always what my teachers in art class said to us was like, if you want to become a Dali, a Picasso, a Cubist, an abstract artist, you have to know the basics first to do them well. But what I want to know, Ezra, is what was your first interaction with a Warhol piece? Because it's about you finding your favorite.
Right. So here's the thing about Warhol. And here's the thing about, so when I was a child, when I was 12 and 13, I was artistic.
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually given for my bar mitzvah art lessons, which I learned how to paint oils and pastels. And I created some things. And when I was 15, I did some more pastels and whatnot. And then I put all my art on hold. And when I was in college, I started going to art museums. And I understood the classics. Mm-hmm. I loved the Dutch Golden Age, the 17th century. I actually, one day, I went to Washington, D.C. from New York, where I lived, and I spent a day or two just in the Dutch Golden Age room in the National Gallery.
So that's Rembrandt?
It's Rembrandt, it's Vermeer, it's and what I loved most about that, I mean, so my master's was in history of comparative religion.
Mm-hmm.
And art was really important for me because I knew Judaism and I know the Old Testament very well and I know all the Jewish sources, but I actually learned a lot about Christianity through art.
Well, right, because the art of the time was how the church communicated to an illiterate populace their religion.
Right.
It's like we have to use paintings, stained glass, sculpture to tell the story of our religion because people can't read it on their own.
And so I learned about a lot of Christianity that way, and that was kind of my jumping off point for learning other things about Christianity because I already had the basics. And then I remember going to museums. And I actually went with a friend who was very into modern art. and contemporary art, and she had gone to art school, and we had one day gone, I think we went to the Met, and then we went to MoMA in New York, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and then to the Museum of Modern Art. And I loved the Met. The Met was amazing. Manet, Velasquez, like everything, I just loved it. And then I didn't understand at all what I saw at MoMA. It wasn't a language which I could speak. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand what I was seeing. And
so to go from such, like, if we just lean in hard to the Dutch period, which is so, I was about to say so figurative, but like had a language of religion, a system of symbols.
So that's actually exactly the opposite. I fell in love with the Dutch because they were the first people who did not have religion in their paintings. They had the first secular paintings.
Okay, so like woman with a pearl earring.
And you have all of these, now of course there were religious paintings, but you have all of these things of those fish dealers and inside a kitchen. And I always had actually compared it to kind of sitcoms because, you know, when we were coming of age, Friends was on. Mm-hmm. And it was like seeing your own kind of life in that picture and saying, oh, we're normal. Now, I've learned since that this may not be completely correct, but the way that I understood it then, and that's all that we're talking about right now, is that, wow, this was showing people. Oh, and the other part of it was that they were also the first people who would create art that was small. Mm-hmm. And they called it cupboard art. And cupboard art was something that everyone could afford, or many people could afford, as opposed to if we think about the earlier masters, we have these massive paintings and those were all in the church and whatnot. So I became obsessed with that. And at the same point, I was studying about Spinoza, who was a philosopher living at the same time-ish. And so art for me was very much, it was combining my past of caring about art and my present of caring about religion and caring about thought and caring about this whole secularization and whatnot. And I just remembered still. And one day, I flipped the switch in my mind. And I think that it was partially because of the
Met MoMA trip.
Maybe, but it was partially because of the Dutch, because my realization was the concept was more what is going on in the mind of the artist. Mm-hmm. What is the artist trying to tell? As opposed to what am I seeing?
So, first Warhol.
I don't remember my first Warhol. That's the weird part about this entire thing.
Okay.
Warhol, at the beginning, I saw Warhol like I saw Lichtenstein and everyone else. And I'm like, okay, these are modern. It's pop art. It's something I get it. It's graphic. It's alive.
So my first Warhol, and why I said he's known for Campbell soup cans, is which Ezra has brought down a Warhol print
of Campbell soup cans.
My parents are both artists. My dad does a lot of screen print. If you're in my living room, you'll see I've got an Obama Lincoln. I've got a George Bush Alfred E. Newman.
Oh, is that your dad?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that. You didn't tell me that. I saw it, and it's like, I've always loved it, and then I'm like, okay, you bought it somewhere, but that's your dad. Those are really cool.
Yeah, those are for my dad. A lot of, I mean, this room is actually the room with, like, out my dad's stuff in it, but the living room has, I don't know, something like 12 pieces for my dad.
And also one from your mom?
Yep. And many also from Phineas Jones, who is not related, but whose art I collect. That's here on the wall. But like all the octopus stuff is Phineas Jones, who I see once a year at a Halloween party. And we have an awkward hello because I'm a huge fan of his. And I'm just like a person he sees once a year at a party. I'm going to say Signal Catalog or Wireless Catalog, which were the catalogs of NPR. Sold a Campbell Soup shirt. And so my sister and I, one of like our first, like a graphic t-shirt that I have a clear memory of was both of us getting a Campbell's Soup t-shirt with like a gold screen print on for like the circle and stuff. So for me, my first Warhol is like very clear. And then I had kind of a college interest in Basquiat, and so I've been to Basquiat exhibits, which you can't see Basquiat without seeing Warhol.
Well, and that I think plays into what I love about Warhol. Warhol from the 60s had this thing called the factory, where was the place where he did his screen prints and where he experimented and where all of anyone who is anyone in New York came to the factory, hung out.
Yeah.
It was the place. And people would work there. And he was the only one paying rent. And everyone else was kind of just living, creating, and, you know.
It's this, like, cool art co-op without the co-op part?
Right.
Yeah.
And he always had this community of people who he would kind of, when I say the word support, I don't mean financially only, but also emotionally. And it was just a group of people. And by the 80s, he was already very famous. And that's when he started Interview Magazine. And he basically at some point said, I want to promote my friends who are artists, and I want to have a platform that I can, well, not only artists, but I want to be able to promote the people I like.
Right.
And Basquiat was one of these, you know, people who he helped just bring out into the world. And then he actually created something like 45, 55, a ton of work with Basquiat.
Yeah.
Now, if you look at those works, I was at a Warhol retrospective a couple of years ago at the Whitney in New York, and you look at everything else, and then you look at the Basquiat Warhols, and there's just this disconnect. I mean, because Basquiat he's amazing, but he's so different. Like,
right, he's like 30 years younger, a young black man.
I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about his art. His art is, I want to say raw.
It's like visceral. I think it is. Yeah, I think raw, visceral.
And Warhol, if there's one word to describe any Warhol, it is very perfectly composed.
That's three words.
Composed.
Right. He's doing screen print. He's experimenting with like the reproduction of an image, like taking something we all think we know and reproducing it and changing it slightly. But it's not like Basquiat is more graffiti and like the energy of street graffiti.
Or the energy of street graffiti meets the energy of, and I mean this with the biggest, you know, positive energy of caveman paintings, of literally what people drew on the walls. It's raw and it's amazing. And the fact that Warhol, who is so perfect in everything he does, could go and produce somebody basically who was just so raw in what he did, and then collaborate with him was just, it spoke mountains about Warhol.
Mm-hmm.
And like I was thinking about in the lead up to this interview podcast thing, us sitting here at this table, just going through my mind of all the different types of Warhols that there are, and also all the kind of homages to Warhol that I have in my own apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And I started realizing, wow, and this is kind of why I said, like, I can't see him only as the
Campbell Soup guy.
Campbell Soup guy. I, like, see him as so much more. But here's the thing about this. Whatever he's known by, whether you say the Campbell Soup, whether you say the Marilyns, whether you say, you know, really whatever, I feel that that Andy Warhol was truly, he was a philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
He was a thinker who was an artist.
Yeah.
And I mean, everybody talks about, you know, one day everyone will have 50 minutes of fame. And
yep.
I'm not even going to go into that because it's not actually the most interesting thing in any way, shape, or form. But I mean, again, he produced a show, I think, in the 80s called 15 Minutes of Fame or yeah. something like that. It was more the concept of celebrity. He took a single celebrity and reproduced them a million mm-hmm. times because Marilyn or whoever he was doing was not the person anymore. They mm-hmm. were a reproduction of a reproduction of a reproduction. Yeah. So even though he was amazing with the silk screens and everything, it was more about the concept of celebrity being reproduced time and time again.
Mm-hmm.
On the flip side, I mean, if we look at the Campbell soup can, it's exact opposite. It's something which is a commodity, which is
a mundane thing. It's a mundane object that everyone has in their house.
And he elevated it, and he also elevated the Brillo boxes
uh-huh.
into pieces of art.
Yep.
And it's kind of his Madison Avenue thinking of how advertisements could be art and how, mm-hmm. you know, all these things could be art. But I really like the way how he kind of messed with our understanding of a celebrity that basically once we make somebody a celebrity, they're kind of cheapened and we don't get the full 100% of them.
Sure.
And on the flip side, his Brillo and his Campbell's is all, it's perfect. There is no loss.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you look at it, the color is always spot on, unlike in his other ones.
Right.
And so that was kind of the first thing which I kind of realized that, you know, he played with these types.
What was your first exhibit? So like you can't think of a first interaction with a Warhol. When did you start seeking out Warhol to see in person?
My relationship with Warhol
mm-hmm.
wasn't about necessarily tracking him down and going to museums and trying to find everything about him.
Okay.
It was different. Like in 2007, 2008, my first attempt at thinking up a startup
mm-hmm.
was actually, I wanted to create something called Interview, intrv.eu. It was a website which...
Yeah, I'm like, it's got to be missing either a vowel yeah, of or... course.
And it would... Because I really loved... I love the art of the interview.
Yeah.
And how, and it was kind of like one of these things where in my mind, I wasn't necessarily connecting this with Warhol, but it was something that, that he cared about. It was...
Did you know when you were trying to make Interview the Startup that no. he had made Interview the Magazine?
No.
Okay.
No. But when I started becoming more, you know, interested in Warhol and more interested in modern art in many ways, it was one of those things that stuck out that stood out at me. And that was like, oh, a kindred spirit. One day I was walking down the street in New York on the West Side somewhere, and I was going to some dinner, some gluten-free place, and I saw this print, and I bought it because it was a saying of Warhol, mm-hmm. and it was just something that spoke to me because I've said the same thing a million times.
So for, again... Ezra brought down a tote bag when he went upstairs before we started, between dinner and recording. He brought back a number of pieces. And this one is a red. It's a red print. Is that Warhol in it?
Yes. So this is a picture of young Warhol. And it says, "The world fascinates me."
Mm-hmm.
And that's my mantra.
Yeah.
And like... It was the answer that I gave you when you asked me. It was the first answer I gave you when you said, well, what's your favorite thing? And I said, I don't know. The mm-hmm. entire world fascinates me, which was, I don't know if I thought of it before I saw the Warhol or
right.
or after
I but saw it. But now you've embraced it.
But I've embraced it and it was and it's part of my personality. But the other thing about Warhol was also that every... He cared about process. So he, on one hand, cared about the philosophy mm-hmm. And about the thoughts behind everything he was doing.
Yeah.
But he also cared about process.
Sure.
And he was playing around and he knew Polaroids, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. He knew screen printing. He even had... I'm not going to go into detail about this, but he had these chromiums or something where it was this kind of metal that he put on something, and then they used urine in order to be the acid. But again, this was, he was so obsessed. Now, I'm sure that there was a philosophical or a
sure.
thought behind it, and it wasn't always the same person. But on the flip side, it was also him saying, here's a new medium. Let me experiment with it mm-hmm. and let me see what can be created.
Right.
And so I feel like the reason why he's my favorite, even though I love his art, I have a lot of his art, is more because of who he was, mm-hmm. because of how he thought, because of how he lived his life, much more than me loving the Campbell soup can. Or, I mean, he had range. He had, like, he created these massive photos of an electric chair and of gruesome car crashes.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, we are all obsessed with that. And he took something which is
grotesque
and elevated it to the art form that we all consider it to be.
Yeah.
He created front pages of newspapers in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
He had just this sense of whimsy. And whimsy is usually meant to be something, you know, kind of silly, what he had a sense of winking at us every single time
mm-hmm.
we see one of his pieces. He's winking at us and saying, you know why I'm thinking this.
Yeah. He's breaking the fourth wall.
Always.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about him. And so I've seen him in museums around the world, and I like most recently I think this retrospective at the Whitney that I went to, I brought at least 4 different guys there, and each time like I found new things, mm-hmm. and I just loved it.
Yeah.
But it was I think one of the first times which I also thought, wow, I've seen snippets. I've seen these individual pieces mm-hmm. of his. I could see any of these and know that they were Warhols, but I never saw it like his oeuvre, his entire
so corpus. Was it organized in a way that as you walked through the Whitney, you walked through the years? Or did they say, this is the room with screen prints, this is the room with photography, was it divided by medium, or was it a chronological viewing so you could experience the progression?
It was more chronological.
Yeah.
Like, if you walked a certain way in, mm-hmm. the first room was really his advertising things.
Okay.
And his kind of more ink and pens, ink sketches or whatever. And his shoes, and he had this thing where he...
Oh, he did do beautifully illustrated, like, whimsical, wild, like, royal shoes, didn't right. he?
Yes, so...
It makes me think of Shel Silverstein, but they're not related at all. Or right. are they?
No, so I don't think that they are, but... sorry, I also randomly have postcards by him from some exhibit I saw.
Ezra has once again gone into his tote bag, which now I think is Mary Poppins' level of infinitesimal objects. And he's pulled out a souvenir set of postcards. So not only did he bring down the World Fascinates Me, a Brillo box, a Campbell's Soup montage, now he has brought down easily another 50 Warhol pieces.
25, I think.
Oh, just 25.
So here are here are some of his shoes that he drew, but if I'm not mistaken, he did a series of shoes based on people.
Uh-huh.
So both men and women, and they were all women's shoes, and they were all their personality translated into a shoe, and that's probably what you're thinking about.
It's something with like possibly more of a Betsy Johnson feel.
Yes.
That's it? Okay.
Yes.
That's what I'm remembering.
That was earlier in his career, but also this is why I say it's somewhat chronological. But also, kind of all his ink drawing things were in the first room. Mm-hmm. But it, like I said, it was also his earlier things, because after a certain year, he wasn't really doing those kinds of inks. And although, I mean, so one thing which I'm not plugging myself, but I've become an artist. In the 10 months,
it's 11 almost months, a year, yeah.
Since the pandemic, and one of the pieces which I created was this painting of Einstein mm-hmm. that then I made into a kind of Warhol inspired like 4 boxes, and then which I turned into a whole project about Einstein, and I researched Einstein because it was just fascinating. And one of the questions which I asked myself was, oh, I know that this piece was inspired by Warhol, but did Warhol ever...
Did you accidentally plagiarize Warhol?
So I didn't.
Okay.
And one of the reasons why Warhol really came up in my mind when I was thinking about Einstein was because Warhol was obsessed with the concept of celebrity. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a whole essay about how Einstein was a celebrity. Mm-hmm. And how Einstein, over since 1980, really became just this massive celebrity that we quote him more than we quote really anyone besides like Oscar Wilde, Mark Twain. Yeah. Like, he's one of the most quotable people around.
Did they ever meet?
Who? Oscar Wilde and Mark Twain?
No. Einstein and Warhol.
No. Einstein died in 56.
Okay.
And Warhol only really came onto the scene five years later.
Okay. I thought maybe Einstein was a little into the 60s.
But. Right. But in 1980, mm-hmm. Warhol was commissioned by the Jewish Museum.
Mm-hmm. Is Warhol Jewish?
No.
Okay.
He's Catholic, Polish, from Pittsburgh. Like, I went to high school, my family's from Pittsburgh. Yep. And but I've never been to the Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh, nor have I been to the Warhol Museum in somewhere in Connecticut, somewhere in around there. And he drew inks of 10 famous Jews. Mm-hmm. And that was the name of the series, like 10 famous Jews. And Einstein's one of them. And they are the most uninspired images you've ever seen. Like,
I have to Google. Keep going.
So, for somebody who's known for his color and his boldness, these are 10 ink drawings of Golda Meir, I think, is one of them. Ben-Gurion may be one of them. Like, just people who, the only reason why they're on there is because they were famous and Jews.
I will link to this. It's on Sotheby's. And it sold for, do you want to guess?
Probably not a ton.
Yeah. Just $2.2 million.
Yeah. So apparently people hated it when it came out. Mm-hmm. And his response was, it will sell. And that was one of these kinds of, you know, parts about him where on one hand he was about the art and on the other hand he was about the business and mm-hmm. commerce. And it's something which I just think a lot about. When I was in LA, I started a fake campaign, basically. I wanted to make t-shirts.
Right.
But I didn't know what to put on the t-shirts.
Yeah.
And I wanted it to be something where it could, again, this is 2014 to 2013, like that would tongue-in-cheek have just this sense of humor where everyone can wear these t-shirts, regardless of what you thought, what your taste was. But that wasn't really offensive to anybody because like got milk is offensive to people who are lactose intolerant. The concept was hashtag boycott bad art. Mm-hmm. And I had all these t-shirts made and then I said, well, in order to do this, you know, one of the things that you do is you make shareable content mm-hmm. for Instagram and for and for whatever. So I created these, the Economist Red, this, and then in white lettering, I did these quotes about bad art and other artists. Uh-huh. From famous artists that would make people just think and convey the concept of bad art. So
Ezra's going back into his Mary Poppins tote bag.
So
and pulling out another framed print.
So this is what I made.
Which is flipping around to a reveal to me.
And this was in every box that we sent of the t-shirt. And then we sent some crayons and some other stuff. And this was a large sticker, which was like when you opened up for unboxing, mm-hmm. like this would be what you saw.
And it said, I always like to see if the art across the street is better than mine. Andy Warhol, boycott bad art.
different points where I was like trying something new or experimenting or kind of thinking about how to translate some thought I had into some practice, whether it was a company, whether it was a campaign, whether it was a collection of art. Mm-hmm. He had something to say about that.
Yeah.
And that was kind of why, like, so when you ask me, like, who's my favorite, it's because I guess I think like him in many ways. Mm-hmm. I care about process. I want to understand how everything works. And he cared about that. He cared about that, too. That was, I think, more than anything else, in the in his execution, it was about the execution. But on the flip side, he touched geopolitics. He touched, you know, the concept of vanity. He touched celebrity. He touched all these different things, and it's just fascinating, like his range. And so that's kind of why. A really long way of saying, for many people, seeing his art would be the first
the instigating moment of a adoration.
And for me, it was the understanding of his art. So Degas, we know the ballerinas, and we think about Degas and ballerinas, and Degas, and this is going to be about Degas and ballerinas. Apparently, what was so fascinating with Degas and ballerinas was his point of view of where he was painting the ballerinas from. He wasn't painting them from off a stage. Mm-hmm. He was painting them from up close. He basically was putting you not seeing them on stage, but putting you seeing them in the studio. Mm-hmm. Which apparently, I did not know this before, but he... It was something that was unlike everyone else did.
Sure.
And so even though he was realistic, you know, his ballerinas look like ballerinas, his philosophy in why he was painting the ballerinas like this was kind of radical. He was changing things, even though we look at him and it's like he looks like everyone else.
Right.
But his point of view is different. And so I think that, like, once I really started understanding Warhol better, it kind of forced me to understand everyone else better. Mm-hmm. And say, okay, what was everyone else thinking?
I wonder what a Warhol would say about... So I'm not on TikTok anymore.
What's TikTok?
Because I wasn't responsible enough to be on it. Mm-mm. I couldn't stop scrolling. The algorithm was so good, and it got me so fast, and I could not do anything when I was on TikTok except for scroll on TikTok. One of the things TikTok decided I was someone who liked art, and there are a lot of craft process videos on TikTok of people doing, whether it's resin pouring or like... Or people who have, like, paint cans tied to strings and they're swinging it over a spinning canvas. And I'm not necessarily interested in the end product, but the video of watching people make that type of art is hypnotic.
So, I think, well, I'll say one thing and then I'll explain. I was at the gift shop of the Whitney 3 years ago, and I don't remember who I was with, but I remember saying something to the lines of, there were, like, Warhol colored pencils. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what would he have said about that? And the guy who was I just remember that he was this very Upper East Side, this wealthy, older gentleman, said, Warhol would have loved this. Like, he was completely just, he loved the concept of commercialization. Mm-hmm. I think Warhol would have loved TikTok videos about the process.
Yeah.
I think that that's exactly the kind of, it's kind of the Venn diagram of the concept of fame. And so this philosophical, let's say, thought, and this concept, and this concept of understanding the process of how paint works, or
right.
And those two things together are like a Warhol wet dream. I mean,
yeah.
Those are like, and the fact that you know, again, with one of the things which I heard about TikTok was that the way the algorithm works, so you're looking at it from the side of the viewer, but from the side of the creator, every creator begins every video with 100 views.
Right.
And so everyone has the chance of going viral.
Mm-hmm.
Has the exact same chance of going viral in that way. Because once they see what the interaction is or something, they
yeah, because you get some endorphins. It's like, oh, my first video got so many views. Okay, I'll make another one.
But also the video, the more people who interact with it, then mm-hmm. then the more that video is shared
right.
with other people, and again, that's kind of, I mean, again, we're not talking about the 15 minutes of fame, but that's World 15 minutes of fame,
right?
It's giving everybody an equal ability to become famous mm-hmm. based on ability rather than who you know.
What is the biggest trip you've ever gone on to interact with Warhol? What's the biggest effort you've ever made to interact with Warhol?
Asking four different guys to go to the Whitney with me.
I mean, that's a solid plan.
A couple were dates, I think. I think one was, and it was friends. But I mean, I think that part of it was just,
I mean, I've had some movies that I've seen. I saw The Big Sick, Kumail Nanjiani's first movie that he wrote. In the theater probably three different times within the first 2 weeks it opened.
You're a fangirl by definition of whatever you fangirl big. You
yeah.
don't go, right now you are wearing a t-shirt that says Bartlett and Hamilton and Lyman and Burr. Like, which is two of your fandoms like just completely colliding because you're a fangirl. That's who you are. And you embrace it.
That is an uncomfortable statement. But true. And only became true with Hamilton. And so this shirt that I'm wearing, that I didn't even think about how we were doing this interview today, is a shirt that Ezra and I went and saw Fun Home, on a Fun Home matinee, like on a Tuesday or Wednesday. What day did they do daytime?
Wednesday.
On a Wednesday in Manhattan. Or on Broadway, sorry. And after that, like, I'm just like, my eyes, I've cried so much I can't open my eyes. It was that day.
Oh my God, I remember this.
And
wow.
Then I had tickets to see Hamilton that night with the original cast, where I had just finally said, you know what, I'm a grown-up business lady, I'm single, I don't have kids. I am paying the equivalent of my rent to go to New York for two nights to see Hamilton original cast, original Broadway cast. And I had won lottery tickets to see Fun Home when it was still being presented in the round. So Ezra and I saw Fun Home and I was like, you know what I need for tonight to go see Hamilton for the first time ever? I was like, I need a custom t-shirt that's a West Wing plus Hamilton t-shirt. Dragged Ezra from Broadway downtown, further downtown. I mean, we went to like a one-room office where they made custom shirts, where their intention was that you ordered the shirt from the internet and they never saw you. And I straight up showed up on their doorstep and I was like, knock, knock, knock. Hello, I would like a ridiculous Hamilton and West Wing shirt made for me before I go see the show tonight. And I will... change in the alley.
I actually think that you got that from the place where I ultimately got all of my custom t-shirts.
Oh, really?
I think so. I don't know how many times I've tweeted about Warhol.
I don't think you need to tweet about your favorite thing in order for it to be your favorite thing.
I get into...
Fangirling is an outward expression of your favorite thing.
Yes.
And this is not the fangirl podcast.
Right. And I don't think that I am the fangirl type of person. Like, I don't have that personality.
Right.
It's
not your brand.
But that said, when I love something, mm-hmm. when I love a director, when I love a artist, when I love a thinker, their work inspires everything else I do. Mm-hmm. And for me, that is the highest compliment. When I see Einstein, I have to think of celebrity. And when I think of celebrity, I have to think of Warhol. And,
sure.
I have to consider what is celebrity based on Warhol, because he's the person who kind of taught me about what celebrity is.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's... So, I mean... I do love so many things, but I think that the thing that, for me, love is really, or obsession, is a thing that gets me to do other things, mm-hmm. and to take that inspiration and create something myself with it.
Yeah. I can easily imagine you, when you sell... Happy Not Happy, or an idea, when you have an idea that gets picked up by VC and then there's an exit and you make your millions, I can fully see you buying a warehouse and that you would want to create a space like the factory.
I've literally had a dream.
Yeah.
And again, I don't know if it was... I don't know if it was before Warhol or after Warhol or during Warhol, but it was my dream to basically have a building mm-hmm. where every floor, like, I'm embarrassed by this, but where the ground floor is like entrance, but also a like kind of cafe and bookstore, because, you know, and tea
that
shop.
That is on brand.
And tea shop and everything, and it's like nice. And then... And then there are business offices and there are studios and everything above. Mm-hmm. And then down below, there is a burlesque, like cabaret, like behind some sort of like false door that people get dressed up every night, because mm-hmm. burlesque and cabaret are two of the greatest art forms in the world.
Yeah.
And like having a building that goes to technology and research and art and performance, like, and other people doing, and people, like, everybody interacting, like, that's my dream.
Yeah.
I still look at places and like, even a couple of weeks ago, I was walking by a place and thought, how much would this building cost?
Yeah.
But, yes, so that's that's my dream.
Yeah.
To have a place where I can be creative, where other people can be creative. Like, one thing which this podcast is, and I mean, I think that you are that person as well. You, like Warhol, promote your friends. And you want to share them with the world. You know that you... have that cachet from, you know, everything that you've done in life, and you know that you've known the people, and you say, I don't want to be here alone, and I don't care about the fame or whatever, like, you shut down your Twitter account when it had a ton because you wanted to just be yourself, but you want to bring other people with you, mm-hmm. and you want to, like, promote people and get them... and get their favorites and get, you know, them understood by other people. So I think that Warhol would have loved you, basically.
Oh. Thank you. Do you have anything you'd like to promote?
Oh, wow.
Do you want people to follow you on the internet?
I mean, you could follow me if you want. I'm not interesting. I'm Ezra Butler in all the different places.
You're also at Ezra Butler Art in some places.
Right. So if you go to EzraButlerArt.com, I believe, it's art that I've created really over the pandemic. And it's been an evolution. And I've also created this project called Atomic Einstein, which is AtomicEinstein.com. And it's really kind of inspired by Warhol in the fact that I'm, or in the way, sorry, that I'm trying to take what I understand about Einstein, for example, and translated into art.
Yep.
So Einstein didn't believe in randomness. So I created a random montage generator, which isn't really random because if you understand computers, there's really no randomness in computers. And I kind of just feel that it's echoing or playing with concepts that I feel that maybe Warhol would have liked, or it would have been a conversation. And so, yeah, AtomicEinstein.com. And I just want to learn about more things.
Yeah.
Don't know how that fit into that.
Yeah, I think when you... So if you go to Ezra Butler Art, if you check out Atomic Einstein, you're going to see all of the amazing things that Ezra has created since COVID started. It started with acrylic paints on manila folders and has expanded to, right now he's got a super fancy iPad in front of me with an iPad, a special like Apple Pencil. He's doing printmaking. This Atomic Einstein effort, there are 5x7s upstairs ready for you to buy. He's got these stained glass windows. He's experimenting with the Japanese art of fixing things. We have these amazing like picture rails in our apartment, and whereas I just painted them a nice white, he's actually gotten the hooks to hang his pictures on. So get to know Ezra Butler online. He won't tell you to follow him, but I will. And he's also like an amazing systems analyst and problem solver. And so if you are looking for someone to help you solve a weird like data problem at work, he's also someone who does that. He is art and science. So Ezra, thank you so much for coming downstairs tonight.
Thank you. And thank you for everything. I mean, I'm here because of you.
And welcome to Chicago.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.